Hello and welcome to the American Compass podcast. My name is Oren Cass. I'm executive director at American Compass. And at American Compass, we've just released Rebuilding American Capitalism, a handbook for conservative policymakers, which is our comprehensive diagnosis of what has gone wrong in the American economy in recent decades and our full agenda for how to set things right. To celebrate the release, we hosted a forum on Capitol Hill to discuss conservative economics with the senators who have been leading the thinking on those topics. We hosted Senator Tom Cotton, Senator Todd Young, Senator Marco Rubio, and Senator J.D. Vance. And this week we are releasing a series of podcasts highlighting the conversations we were able to have with each of the four. Please also be sure to check out the full handbook at americancompass.org. And on the Rebuilding American Capitalism homepage, you'll also find a link to watch the forum in its entirety. Our fourth and final conversation for today is with Senator J.D. Vance. Senator Vance has made quite a mark in a short time in Washington, both with his innovative thinking on economic policy and the remarkable progress he's made on a range of concrete legislative proposals. This conversation touched on that experience and, in particular, his thinking on financialization and what has gone wrong with investment in America. And also labor and how conservatives should think about labor unions, what that means for economic policy, and also what it could mean for the future of a conservative political coalition. We hope you enjoy.
One of my favorite moments from the campaign trail, I'm going to embarrass one of my staffers, but I won't actually point him out so you all can just think about who I'm talking about and laugh at them in the abstract, but not precisely. One of my favorite moments of the campaign is someone was in our office, our Cincinnati headquarters, and was eating something sweet, and my body guy said to this person, "A moment on the lips, forever on the hips," which is a phrase I've used commonly. I just made eye contact with him putting an entire brownie in his mouth. So I'll repeat, a moment on the lips, forever on the hips.
Well, that was going to be my first question. So thank you for getting that out.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for having me. It's good to see you. It's good to see so many bright smiling faces, some familiar, some unfamiliar. But I'm a huge fan of what you're doing, and I'm glad to be here.
Well, really appreciate it. We sort of penciled you down for whatever we hadn't covered by the time you got here.
Great. Glad to be cleanup.
Cleanup in the best sense of the word. The two things I was hoping we could touch on in particular that are something we write a lot about in this book. One is financialization and what's going on.
Yep.
Sort of Wall Street versus the real economy. It was years ago I recall hearing you make this point that stuck with me. You know, the best neuroscientists in America, if they're maximizing their own interests, are working on addictive algorithms right now. How do you diagnose, you were in industry, how do you diagnose what's actually going on with capitalism in a sense? Are we getting investment where it needs to go? Or if not, why not?
Yeah, so there's an interesting, there's always a question about whether this is the chicken or the egg that we're talking about here, but let me sort of sketch out the problem and kind of how I see this shaking out. So the point that you're pointing out, or the point that you're reminding me of is, so when I was in Silicon Valley, one of the things that we tried to invest in was sort of next generation technology companies. And we largely tried to avoid the sort of business-to-business software as a service companies that were dominant in the Valley, where you're trying to take some sort of marginal business process, automate it with software, scale the product very quickly, and then sell it to a private equity firm for between $2 and $5 billion. That wasn't interesting to us. It sort of wasn't our theory of the case for how best to allocate capital. And I remember I was on Willow Road, which is the exit on Highway 101 in Northern California, where if you sort of take it to its logical extension and also its physical extension, you end up in the Facebook headquarters, which at the time was sort of booming, right? I mean, Facebook's going through some business struggles right now, but in 2014, 2015, this was sort of the center of the Silicon Valley tech economy. You could literally show up and like get free $400 headphones as the guest of an employee, much less as the employee himself. And of course, I took advantage of that. And I remember going to a couple of companies on Willow Road or right off of Willow Road that were trying to solve the most important healthcare problems that we face. And in my view, the single most important healthcare problem that we face in this country is that you have people who are living 10, 15 years longer at the high end than what they were living before, and yet our brains aren't living nearly as long, or at least we're not getting nearly as much high-quality cognitive power out of our longer lifespans. And so this is a huge, huge problem for us to solve. Now, if you're a neuroscientist, you can make, if you're lucky, $180,000, and this is in 2014, 2015, $180,000, more like $150,000, working in a neuroscience startup that was trying to figure out how to solve the Alzheimer's problem. And yet, if you were willing to go just a little further down the road, you would make twice that much or maybe three times that much developing highly addictive predictive algorithms for Facebook. And this struck me as a massive, massive market failure. And the traditional free market response to this is, well, clearly this is what people value more if they're willing to pay three times as much for a neuroscience to addict you to an to build an application that addicts you, but they're only willing to pay $150,000 for solving Alzheimer's, then clearly that is just the proper allocation of capital, is to pay the neuroscientist to addict us to these applications. And it kind of hit me just as an obvious problem. And even if this was somehow the outcome of a pure efficient market, which I don't think that it is, but even if it was, then we should be able to say common sense is we care more about solving Alzheimer's than we do about addicting 12-year-olds to Facebook. So we should be trying to find ways to pay that neuroscientist more to solve the most important problems. That's sort of fundamentally, when I think about industrial policy, that's what I think it fundamentally is recognizing where we need to direct our country's resources to solving real problems as opposed to fake problems, or even solving problems in a way that creates more problems. Now, the interesting question, Oren, is why is it like this, right? Why is the Facebook engineer making so much more money to work on something that I think is fundamentally socially invaluable? And I think most Americans would probably agree with me. And one of the fundamental issues here is that there has been a massive return to financialization and digitization, and there's been much, much less return as a capital allocator or as an employee to some of these other things. In other words, it makes pure economic sense if you're viewing this from the perspective of a neuroscientist to go and work at Facebook than to go and work in solving Alzheimer's. Or to take another example, if you're a really, really smart mathematical mind, does it make sense to go and, let's say, develop fusion energy and figure out how to solve the world's most important energy problem? Or does it make sense to go and work at a quantitative hedge fund where you develop complex trading algorithms? Well, if you're looking at it from a pure financial returns perspective, you would be an idiot to have gone to work on fusion energy 20 years ago, but you would have been really smart if you had gone and worked at Citadel or at Renaissance or at one of these things. So there's clearly a very fundamental problem here. And I guess the worry that I have, to throw a little bit of cold water on sort of my own views and just play devil's advocate a little bit, is maybe the reason that we have more people going to work on addicting kids to apps and quantitative trading algorithms has a little bit more to do with the fact that we're just a structurally stagnant society technologically. And it's not just the incentives of the individual marketplace. It's a much, much deeper and harder problem to solve. And I think the truth is there's probably sort of both sides of that are true. In other words, it's really, really hard to solve the Alzheimer's problem. That's one of the reasons why neuroscientists aren't solving it. It's really, really hard to solve the fusion energy problem. That's one reason why you have all these smart mathematical minds going to Renaissance. But it is a problem fundamentally of incentives too. And the thing that we can fix is the incentives. We can't make it easier to scientifically discover the solution to the Alzheimer's problem, but we can align the incentives better so that the smartest people are working on the problems that are most worth solving.
And so what does that look like? Is that, you know, I think the, to your point that at the end of the day, what industrial policy means is noticing the things that matter, the problems that actually need solving, and getting the talent and the capital there. The problem, I think, you know, to throw cold water on my own ideas, is like we don't really have some agency that's gonna that's gonna nail that necessarily. And so, how do you, from your perspective, start to think about not what the legislation is, but even the directions that are on your mind that you're exploring?
Well, there are a lot of different answers to this question, right? So one of the things that I think is definitely wrong with corporate America is that you have much less capital investment in long-term outcomes than you used to maybe 30, 40, certainly 60 or 70 years ago. So one thing is corporate America is just much more risk-averse from a pure capital allocation perspective. But let's be honest, corporate America is much more is much more risk-averse from a sort of corporate culture perspective, right? So one of the things that's going on here to sort of meld my economic views with a little bit of culture war analysis is we've done a lot of things to human resources departments. We've done a lot of things when it comes to things, to issues like affirmative action that have made, I think, a lot of companies much less willing to take on risks and have changed the corporate culture in a way that you have far fewer people who are just raw, let's figure out the problem, let's try to put a lot of money to it, and let's try to make a lot of money out of solving that problem. And you have a lot of people who are terrified of their own shadow in corporate America, right? That's like a human resources issue. And by the way, I think that our human resources regime, the entire sort of American legal regime behind it, has probably made that problem worse. But then there's another sort of very easy problem or sort of easy way of thinking about this problem, which is it's like fundamentally a problem of incentives, right? So how you do this, there are a lot of different questions about how you can make financialization pay less and solving real problems pay more. And we're sort of starting to think about some things in our office about how we would solve that. I'm sure that you've thought in some detail about this. And this is something I expect to be working on quite a bit over the next 2 to 3 years. But at a fundamental level, the problem is pretty straightforwardly put. We need to make working on real things pay more money than it does right now. And we need to make working on fake things pay less money than it pays right now. That's the fundamental problem. It is purely an incentive problem, or at least to the extent that we can solve it or at least help it from Washington, D.C., it's reasonably straightforward an incentive problem. And I think that's one thing we can fix with better public policy.
And it's interesting, there are two sides to that, whether you want to call it the sort of make it pay more, make it pay less, or the carrot and the stick.
Yeah.
I think people are particularly politically a lot more comfortable starting to inch into the we need to make some good things pay more.
Yes.
We'll talk about, there's a market failure here, we need to reward X. And a lot less comfortable inching into the that doesn't look so great. We probably should make that pay less. I understand that political calculation. I would also argue to some extent, though, that from a policy function perspective, it is frankly a lot easier to make some things pay less. And so I'm curious to what extent you have preferences for one or the other. You see it as a both and. What are you comfortable seeing government do in that respect?
Yeah, I mean, I ran my campaign as a very non-conventional Republican, which has its downsides. And I've governed to the extent that we've done much governing in the past 6 months in this country in a very non-conventional way. I'm sort of comfortable saying both and. I am not, and look, even some of my Republican colleagues who are aligned with us on a lot of these issues would sort of be terrified at the suggestion that maybe we should actually penalize American corporations for offshoring American jobs, okay? Make it pay more. I think we should be doing that. Now, there are people who are terrified of that implication. I think it was in my opening speech I proposed a tax on corporations that ship American jobs overseas. So I'm much more okay with that. I'm much more okay with that stuff. And the basic formulation, and I think even our sort of hyper-libertarian economics friends would agree with this basic formulation, is you get more of what you subsidize and you get less of what you tax, right? So let's tax the things that we want to see less of, and let's subsidize the things we want to see more of. And I think on net, it will probably equalize. I don't want to see a substantially larger federal government, in part because I think the federal government is so bad at these things. And this is one really big issue with industrial policy writ large. I had this conversation with Jared Bernstein recently, and Jared Bernstein is, I don't know that I would call him a friend, certainly an acquaintance. He and I have interacted a lot. I think he's a very smart guy. I think he's probably one of the best people we could have gotten out of the Biden administration as chief economist, but I voted against his confirmation. Why did I vote against his confirmation? For the very simple reason that he leaned way too heavily into all the woke bullshit. And I'm sorry if I'm not allowed to say this in this room, this august room, and here I am cussing and dropping four-letter words.
But we have babies in the back.
Family, we do. Actually, I'm so sorry. Luckily, the babies that I've seen, and I'm glad that they're here, God bless you guys, they're too small to repeat the things that I say, which, by the way, is not true of my three-year-old, who's very, very into repeating the things that Daddy says, and it gets me in all kinds of trouble. He dropped the F-bomb on an airplane the other day. Bad situation, but... The issue here is, okay, so I would have voted for the CHIPS bill. I think the CHIPS bill is very good for the state of Ohio. I think it is one of the most critical things that we can do to migrate more semiconductor manufacturing to the United States of America and to allied nations. Okay, start with that premise. But when Gina Raimondo, the Secretary of Commerce, is taking the language in the CHIPS bill and conditioning the money that comes out of the CHIPS bill on, you need to do the things that I want you to do on paid family leave, on in diversity, equity, and inclusion, you do two things. One, you use good sort of policy at the high level to accomplish very terrible things in the actual application, right? There are a lot of things that Gina Raimondo is trying to use the CHIPS bill for that I think is not just not good, it's actively bad. But then the second problem that you cause is that you distract and destroy the political willpower for something that 90% of the country thinks that we need to do. No one in Ohio, even Republican primary voters who have voted in every Republican primary for their entire lives, no one cares that the Wall Street Journal editorial board doesn't like the CHIPS bill on free market economic grounds. But here's the problem. They really don't like it when the Secretary of Commerce forces them or their suppliers or a company in their community to adopt a diversity, equity, and inclusion program because of the money that the CHIPS bill authorized, right? So we have to be really careful about this. And to our friends on the left who are sort of open to a lot of the ideas that you've been pushing for pretty much as long as I've known you, the way to destroy right-of-center willpower for anything that looks like industrial policy is to use industrial policy to get progressive social policy through the back door, what you could never accomplish through the front door. And that's the big risk of the Biden administration. There are some things, I will say, at least rhetorically, where I think the Biden administration has picked up on a lot of the good that the Trump administration has done and ran with it. But if you're going to use the CHIPS bill to force Intel and Intel suppliers to adopt a diversity, equity, and inclusion program that's offensive to 60% of Ohio voters and 90% of Republicans, you're going to destroy the willpower to do what we need to do in this country. And that's the biggest risk of the Biden administration. They're actively making it harder for us to make these arguments because every time we do something good, or at least a lot of the times we do something good in this building, they screw it up with the way they implement it.
So I agree entirely with that. I was in a very interesting panel discussion with Congressman Ro Khanna, who I think is generally sympathetic to a lot of the same thinking you or I might have, and either very genuinely loved the childcare and DEI requirements in the CHIPS regs, or had a D next to his name and had to support them. But this point that you made, that doing that it's bad in the specific, but is catastrophic in what it means for the prospect of actually making progress on this, I think is an incredibly important point. And what I've been struck by talking with sort of my counterparts on the left who are interested in industrial policy and, you know, big Inflation Reduction Act types, they were genuinely stunned that anyone was even upset about this. They were like, this is how government power works. Obviously, when we are in power, this is what we get to do. And I'm curious, I think you've importantly made a real mark reaching across the aisle and finding place of common ground.
Yeah.
Have you had any of these conversations with folks on the other side? And is there any prospect of reaching a point where people understand if we're going to get things done, we have to leave some of this other stuff to the side?
Yeah, so let me say two things. Number one, there is broad agreement on exactly that point, that to get some of these things done, we have to leave some of the progressive social policy, agree or disagree, and I obviously disagree with nearly all of it, we have to leave some of that stuff to the side. I think Jared Bernstein recognizes this, especially when you talk to him one-on-one. I think that a lot of my colleagues in the Senate recognize this. Again, especially when you talk to them one-on-one, they know that there are things that we agree on and there are things that we disagree on. And if you use the things that we agree on to sort of subversively get something we disagree on in the public policy arena, that's going to make it very hard for us to ever work together. Now, at the same time, look, the reality is exactly as Roe and as others, or I'm not saying you're necessarily imputing this view to Roe, but whoever said this, it is fundamentally the truth that when the bad guys rule the government, they get to do the things that they want to do. And when the good guys rule the government, they get to do the things that they want to do. And the problem with, frankly, some of our interlocutors on the right is that their worldview appears to be that every time Republicans gain a governing majority, they have to sit on their hands and do nothing with it, acknowledging that whenever the left gets a governing majority, they're going to do exactly what they want to do with it. Well, that just means that we lose, but a little bit more slowly than we would otherwise lose. And the counterargument I make, even though, look, I really, again, want to emphasize that what Secretary Raimondo is doing with the CHIPS bill is really bad news for a whole host of reasons. The counterargument to the idea that, well, we can't give the power to government, we can't give any power to government because then the left might misuse it, is to look at the United States military. Right. If your argument is Gina Raimondo may misuse the CHIPS bill, therefore we cannot do the CHIPS bill, well, I guess we should abolish the Department of Defense because Joe Biden's doing a lot of crazy crap with the Defense Department that I don't think that he should do. Does that mean we shouldn't have a U.S. military? No, it means we should advance a political program that's popular and that can win so that when we win, we can get to do with the military what we want to do. Okay? And in fact, the real solution here is to win a durable enough governing majority, not that we're going to win every election, but that the craziest stuff that the left tries to do, it stops trying to do because it realizes there are political downsides to doing it. I really do not think, for example, a majority of Americans, in fact, I'm quite confident that 70% of Americans don't think that their tax dollars should be going to do hormonal therapy for 19-year-old new enlistees in the United States military, okay? But in order for us to win that argument, we have to win political power, implement our agenda, and then be reelected. And that sort of is where I think maybe this whole conversation is most important. There is no path to a durable governing majority for the conservative movement that doesn't run through a rethinking of 1980s and 1990s economic dogma. And I know, you know, sort of the Trump question, of course, always leads to strong disagreements. But let me say this for Donald Trump, recognizing that not every person in this room is going to agree with me. The criticism that is made of Donald Trump from a lot of quarters, especially in this town, is, well, the problem that I have with Donald Trump is that he didn't win, right? We didn't win in 2018, we didn't win in 2020, and we didn't do as well as we should have in 2022. And my counterargument to that is, well, we did really, really well in 2008 and 2012. Oh, wait, we lost historic landslides in 2008, and we lost a pretty bad election in 2012, and the amount of public policy the Democrats were able to accomplish over the intervening decade has left its mark in a permanent way, okay? So the solution is not, oh, we need to go back to the pre-Trump consensus. Even if you don't like Donald Trump, and I obviously do, I think that he's done a lot of good for the country. Even if you don't like Donald Trump, the answer is not to go back to what came before him. That is a dead end. We've gone down that pathway a lot of times, and we always end up slamming our face into the walls.
Well, and on that note, thank you everyone for coming. I wanted to awkwardly and sharply shift topics, but I'm going to grasp your use of the phrase durable governing majority to make it seem like a smooth segue, because it would not be an American Compass palooza, I don't know what we call this, without a discussion of labor.
Yeah.
And I think you've really distinguished yourself as someone who is genuinely interested in the topic and the question of what are unions, what are the good things about unions, what are ways to actually constructively reform them, how can we bring more workers and union members into the conservative movement. I'm curious now that you're actually sort of an elected official, what your perspective on that is. Where do you see as the biggest opportunity?
Yeah, so let me address a couple of comments to some of our some of our critics from the right who I think largely agree with us on things like maybe trade and immigration, but are very skeptical of the idea that labor will ever be aligned with the right of center. And you hear this a lot from sort of folks, they'll say, oh, you know, J.D. Vance thinks the unions are going to be base. The unions are never going to be base. They're always going to be progressive and left-wing, right? Let me sort of say two things about this. One of them as a concession, one of them as a refutation. Okay, so the first point that I'll make is a concession, and that's that when I was running for my Senate race, there were a lot of union halls that I went and spoke to, and a lot of people who said, we're going to vote for you, our membership is going to vote for you, but the leadership literally will not let us endorse you, okay? So there is a problem, but the problem is not union membership, especially the trades unions, the builders, the carpenters, the electricians, and so forth. But there is a fundamental leadership problem. And I've asked this question to a number of labor lawyers. I've yet to get a good answer. But we have to figure out why it is that labor membership is increasingly on our side and labor leadership is increasingly aligned, or not increasingly, but is statically aligned with the left, right? I'm convinced that there is a structural reason why this is true. If you're a labor lawyer and you have an idea, please come to me because I want to fix this problem. Because it's ridiculous if you have 70 to 80% of a given union and the Carpenters and Millwrights Union in Northeastern Ohio voting for J.D. Vance in 2022, and yet the national leadership is shoveling their union dues to the Democratic Party. Like, that is a fundamental unfairness. And we shouldn't just fix it because it's in our interest as Republicans. We should fix it because it's unjust and it's a problem. So we should sort of target that particular issue. On that point, and this is sort of the point where I think you and I agree and where I think there is a real fertile ground for us. I mentioned the Carpenters and Millwrights Union in Northeastern Ohio. It was one of the few events before the general election that both Tim Ryan, my Democrat opponent, and me were both at. The door prize at the Carpenters and Millwright Union event was an AR-15. Okay?
I'm just going to assume that's legal. I'm not going to ask how that...
That's a good question. I don't know. But, like, these are our guys, ladies and gentlemen. These are increasingly our voters. They hate the woke BS. They hate the diversity stuff. They just want to go to their jobs, earn a good, livable wage for their families. They're fundamentally aligned with us on both issues of economics and of culture. And we just have to find some way to get them more and more on our side. Now, one story that I want to sort of give on this just highlights how much of an opportunity there is with labor. I was talking recently with the leadership of one of the largest airlines in America, and they were talking about a particular pilot role. I'm one of these guys who's extremely concerned that, you know, I don't like the diversity, equity, inclusion thing. Obviously, I brought it up like 4 or 5 times. You know where I really don't like it is with pilots, because my kids fly a lot. They, you know, their grandparents live in California, and obviously their son, their dad's a senator in D.C., and they live in Cincinnati. I want my kids to have the two best pilots that they could possibly have every time they get into an airplane. So the diversity stuff, I don't like it when it comes to college admissions. I really, really hate it when it comes to airplanes. That's the scariest thing ever. Like, I was talking to the leadership of airlines, and I raised this issue. I said, look, a lot of the things that you guys are talking about, some policies you've already implemented, some policies you're thinking about implementing, these things could very well lead to lower qualified, lower standards in our pilot corps. And their response is to sort of try to poo-poo and avoid and not really discuss the question. And then the leadership of the airline says something that I think every conservative should take to heart. He said the reason why we can't really implement this stuff as much as we want to is because the pilot unions, black, white, Latino, the pilot unions of the membership of every skin color really hates this stuff. Okay, right? Whatever you want to say about labor unions, as pissed off as I am that the national leadership of the Carpenter and Millwright Union didn't endorse me in 2022, if the labor unions are going to keep our pilots the highest safety standards, the highest quality possible, then we need to find some way to help them out. And we need to find some way to bring them into our coalition. Now, are there structural problems? I just mentioned those. Yes. Are there still some cultural problems that we have to get over? Absolutely. But fundamentally, labor should be on the side of the American right for the next generation, and it will be if we don't screw it up.
On that note, I promised the architect of the Capitol we would wrap up at 4. I assumed you'd rather hear from Senator Vance than some sort of vague conclusion from me. So I hope you found this very energizing, and we are abruptly going to conclude. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much.